The theoretical and empirical debate over the ability of the U.S. Supreme Court to influence public opinion through its decisions is far from settled. Scholars have examined the question using a variety of theoretical perspectives and empirical evidence, but there is no theoretical consensus, nor are the empirical studies without methodological weaknesses. That writer in the Political Research Journal in 2006 says that the U.S. Supreme Court's influence on public opinion has yet to be proved. But as measures of public opinion become more sophisticated, what are we finding out about the court's influence on the way Americans think? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What Supreme Court decisions are Americans most aware of? What's the best way to measure the public's response to Supreme Court decisions? And how does public opinion affect the court? Our guests are Charles Franklin, professor of political science at the UW-Madison, and Leanne Kosacki, who is on the faculty of the Center for Law, Society, and Justice.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks. Thanks
Good
for having
to be
us.
Here.
Let's start with the Supreme Court itself as an institution. If we go back to sort of the original conception and just the way that it is related to the other two branches of government, I mean, here's an institution where nobody's elected, and there it is. How much power was it originally conceived of having, and why do you, you know, what can you say about the court itself?
Well, it's an interesting thing to look at the history of the court because there was clearly at the start a concern about its the reason this becomes an issue is because of its anti-democratic so-called tendencies. The idea that you have this appointed body of justices who sit for life or good behavior, who basically are once appointed really answerable to no one. And the argument could be made that this is a good thing because it makes them independent of political forces. And yet at the same time, how could you ensure that they wouldn't become tyrannical, wouldn't become full of themselves? And I think the answer that the Federalists, that's in the Federalist Papers, that's attributed to Hamilton was the idea that the court has just the power of judgment. They see the power of will, but not the power of the purse or the sword. And so the idea here is that the court can do whatever, can say whatever it wants. It can decide cases however it wants, but it is ultimately dependent on the other branches of government to implement its decisions. And so as a result, there's a kind of a weird dance that has to go on between the court and the public. And because ultimately, a lot of what we're looking at in this area is indirect effects, is how the court has to be dependent on other branches, but yet not really directly being able to do very much on its own.
What was its original intent? To interpret the Constitution, or was that a little later?
Boy, that's a tough... I think, actually, the original intent was the idea that you'd have a federal court. Prior, if you look at the Articles of Confederation, for example, there was no federal court system. There was no national court system. And so as a result, particularly if you had disputes that occurred between citizens of two states, there was no, it wasn't clear what the forum would be. Who would, and obviously whoever, and you had great examples of this, where citizens of one state would take their case to the courts in their state, and the courts in their state, no surprise, would find on behalf of their own citizen. And then, you know, the other party would take the case. And so you get these conflicting decisions, and it was very difficult. And I think very early on, the founders certainly felt that there should be a national court system to mediate these, what really were very important economic cases. And then I think also there was a sense that there needed to be some national forum to talk about the meaning of the Constitution on a national basis, as opposed to states having that ultimate power.
And then fairly early on in the history of the court, we get Marbury versus Madison, where the court asserts its right to interpret laws in the Constitution.
That's right. And so when in Marbury versus Madison, which is the case that's attributed where judicial review, the power of judicial review, that is the power of courts to declare laws constitutional or not, is established. And so initially, there wasn't a whole lot of attention paid to that decision. There was some controversy, but it sort of died away as obviously as history has unraveled or unfolded. We've certainly seen that the courts have used that power to great effect.
And if we jump ahead 100 years plus, more than 100 years, you know, the court doesn't automatically get compliance with its decisions. So, you know, one of the most famous cases of the last 100 years would have to be Brown versus Board of Education.
1954.
Exactly. That's right. Which called for school desegregation with all deliberate speed. But it's 10 more years before we start to see any kind of widespread school desegregation throughout the South. And indeed, some states with some federal judges moved pretty directly to desegregate, while others found lower-level judges able to block desegregation for years to come. So the idea that the court gains compliance automatically with its decisions, even within the federal court system, let alone with the public at large, really has not been true in our last 50 or 60 years, or I would say most any time during the history of the court.
One of the virtues of the Constitution has been its deliberate vagueness, which has enabled, you know, a very flexible Constitution to last us for more than 200 years. Is that sometimes true with Supreme Court decisions? I mean, you mentioned deliberate speed. Deliberate speed in Charleston, South Carolina could be different from that in Minot, North Dakota.
I'll let Leanne follow up on this, but I think in general, the court is aware or has generally been aware of some of the limits of its power to coerce citizens or institutions to comply. And so you find decisions written with vague terms like all deliberate speed rather than by next January 1st, right? And so I think the court preserves its power as an institution in part by being sensitive to the limits of its ability to impose things. But think of some of the continuing debates that we've seen over 50 years on prayer in schools, for example, something from the 1960s that nevertheless remains controversial today. Roe versus Wade and abortion, of course, is probably the strongest example of that. But the court can't assume that it will automatically have its orders complied with, and therefore is somewhat circumspect when it makes many decisions, not all decisions, but many decisions.
And I think actually that raises that issue of direct versus indirect. That is that I think the court, and there certainly are periods, the one that comes most to mind is the New Deal, where the court was striking down New Deal policies as unconstitutional. And essentially, especially during the first Roosevelt administration, sort of saying, and there are examples where essentially historians have said what the court was doing was essentially saying, we don't think this is what the public wants. And then comes the reelection of FDR by a landslide.
Kind of an affirmation.
And then you see the court very quickly tacking in a different direction. All of a sudden, the programs of the New Deal are okay. They're all constitutional. And it there's, you know, that's the example of what they call the switch in time that saved nine, because Roosevelt, FDR was talking about the court packing plan during
adding,
that period,
right before that
election. And the court very quickly, a member of the court, Justice Roberts, just changing and voting along with the minority of four in favor of New Deal policies. And really, I think that this happens where the court sometimes may be out of step ideologically with the public, may wonder if they're doing what the public would like. Because I think the research has shown that, generally speaking, the court will act in concert with what it perceives as dominant public opinion,
as opposed to what the law says, though? I mean, isn't it really to interpret the law, not to guess what people might want, regardless of what the law says?
Well, and I think that's a very interesting point, because I think certainly at the level of the Supreme Court, and you saw this with something that came up during the confirmation hearings for Justice Kagan, where Justice Kagan talked about two analogies that you can use about Supreme Court decision-making. One analogy is to talk about the court as an umpire that calls balls and strikes. Her argument was that really wasn't quite it. That really, and I think this is correct, that really what is going on at that level is that the cases that come to the court are present hard questions. There often is not a clear-cut answer. And so one of the things that needs to be done at that point is not just to look at the law, and in fact, in those cases, the law is often not clear, but also to look at a number of things that people might consider policy or public opinion, but really a number of other factors that would be considered in looking at a decision and whether a decision should go one way or the other and what the rationale should be. And I think that's perfectly legitimate. I don't think that it's the case that those are extra legal, because to some extent law always takes into consideration those outside factors.
So you mentioned that the court, that the members are appointed for life. They're not elected, so in a way they're not answering to anybody. One thing that seems unusual or odd almost about the court is that the judges, the justices, don't have to say they're a Republican or a Democrat, mm-hmm. yet often the appointment is a very political thing, and the confirmation hearings, like you mentioned, tend to split on party lines. So it's sort of a strange thing where they are supposedly beyond politics, yet it's hard to be beyond politics when it's part of a three-branch system.
This is one of the areas where judicial scholars in law schools and attorneys and judges and the academic political science views are a little bit different. There's very good evidence that justices appointed by Republican presidents do vote differently on the issues before the court than justices appointed by Democratic presidents. And political scientists tend to call that ideology, liberal or conservative justices. My friends in the law schools and the judiciary really resent that term ideology because it implies a kind of crass partisanship. But they're pretty comfortable with the idea of judicial philosophy. And you can argue about whether there's a dime's worth of difference between one person's ideology and another's philosophy. But I don't think there's much doubt in the empirical data of Supreme Court decisions, and for that matter, lower court decisions, that justices do bring, whether you call it a philosophy or an ideology, to their views of the Constitution. But that doesn't make it illegitimate. If anything, our system is built around the contest of ideas between the parties and philosophical or ideological beliefs. There's an old cartoon that's widely cited in this area that the justices follow the election returns. And that's particularly appropriate to what Leanne was saying earlier about the switch in time in the New Deal era. But there's also the element that these justices don't sit and read every new Gallup poll to try to figure out which way the winds are blowing. Another way that control comes in is through the appointment process. So President Bush gets to make some appointments. That moves the court a bit to the right. Now President Obama has made two appointments. That's moved the court a little bit back to the left. It's a long-term effect of elections that they determine who gets to pick the next justices, and we have abundant evidence that who picks the justice has some effects in how those justices are likely to see the law and interpret the law over the long haul.
Do you think it's odd that the justices continue to wear the robes? In other words, we don't see members of Congress in a particular costume. There is this mystique, mm-hmm. Sort of a secrecy about the court that's different than any other body in this country, isn't it?
It is different in the sense, in many ways, actually, and I think the mystique is probably a good way to put it. I think that image, to some extent, contributes to this notion that the law is a majestic institution, that it is speaking not from a partisan or crass political viewpoint, but that instead the law actually means something that is important, that really transcends those kinds of everyday give and take of politics, that it really is going for something more permanent and more lasting. And part of that actually may be related, or maybe not, but is related to the fact that the courts really, when you come down to it, don't have a whole lot to back them up other than basically belief that what they're doing is correct and fair. And so, for instance, if people perceive the courts as being just crassly political institutions that just did whatever they wanted to do, as opposed to what was in some way fair or constitutionally justified, I think that there would certainly be resistance and perhaps and actually defiance of court proceedings. And certainly we've seen that in the history of, over the history of the U.S., where the courts have had have made decisions and people have just said, well, forget it. We're just not going to go along with that. That has led to some crises, and certainly even the prospect that someone might ignore the court's decision has led to some real big constitutional concerns. Fortunately, I don't think we've had anything where a president has flat out said, at least in recent times, that they won't obey the
sounds
court.
Well, but Andrew Jackson does come
yes.
to mind, though.
But that's not modern.
They've made this decision about not being able to remove the Indians right. to the west of the Mississippi. Now let's see them enforce it.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. But certainly in the showdown over the Nixon tapes,
yes,
there was a lot of concern, and ultimately the president turned that material over. And so I think it's always a question when those clashes come up, hopefully not frequently, but it's really where you see the, I think the tension comes out in part because it's not quite clear what would happen if that did take place. And I think it's something that I'm glad has not happened, I guess, is the way to put it.
It does raise the question of enforcement, doesn't it? Because the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. sure, it can make a decision, and that's then the law of the land. But if it's not enforced, the Supreme Court's really out of it, aren't they? I mean, there's nothing more they can do about it.
They can rule on future cases.
Right.
So if we took a couple of examples, again, old examples, so we can kind of see their path. The rights of the accused in the Miranda warnings, that you have the right to remain silent and anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, right? That's one that was very much resisted initially, till today, minor technical flaws in the Miranda warnings can lead the guilty to go free. But because criminal cases come up again and again and again every day, there's plenty of opportunity for the court to reinforce that ruling, say, yes, we really meant it, and yes, it even applies in this particular circumstance. So that's an example of the kind of case that you get frequently reinforced rulings on. In the case of school prayer, where lots of people still would believe that prayer in public schools of a non-denominational sort is something compatible with their values, the court has had to repeat decisions on that case without it becoming particularly accepted among those who would prefer to have prayer represented in the public sphere somewhere. And so that one hasn't really gone away, whereas I don't think you would find very many police departments or attorney generals or prosecutors today who would seriously dispute the Miranda warnings. They'd certainly contest whether a particular instance mm-hmm. violated it or not. But the broad notion that defendants have to be warned is widely accepted now in a way that I think the school prayer decision has not been equally accepted.
What about the impact of the Bush v. Gore Supreme Court sort of intervention in that election? What sort of impact do you think that had on the relationship between the judicial and the executive branch?
Oh, I was thinking about the public opinion issues.
All of it, I guess. Because that was a pretty unique spot for the Supreme Court to be in, where you have a country waiting to find out who's going to be president, and then the Supreme Court makes that ruling.
And I think, a colleague actually who was here at Wisconsin, Bert Kritzer, did some work on that. And it was very interesting because in looking at public opinion data, what he found was that there weren't changes in levels of Supreme Court support. That is, the levels of people who said they thought the Supreme Court was a good institution remained the same. But if you looked at the underlying structure, what you found that was that there was quite a difference where Democrats really, their support of the court went down, and Republicans, no surprise, it went up.
Depending on who wins.
Right, mm-hmm. And so it evened out. So if you looked at just the level of support, you would say, well, there was no impact. But if you looked at the structure, there was certainly some impact there. And there has since been a return, I think, to the as time has passed, there's been a return back to the sort of original levels, I think, on both sides. But it's been, there was certainly a short-term impact on that.
It's also an interesting case where the court might have chosen not to hear the case at the time it did. It could have let the Florida courts deal with it some more. But at least some of the justices have argued that this case was so important it was going to be before them sooner or later anyway, and that the court should just go ahead and end the process. You know, the problem here, of course, is that they didn't want to be setting precedent that would then apply to every subsequent contested election, mm-hmm. making the Supreme Court the arbiter of every close election that follows. And so they wrote the decision in an unusual way to try to circumscribe its effects only to the particular mm-hmm. Florida circumstances. So when we've had subsequent elections that were incredibly close, like the interminable recount in the Minnesota Senate race or the Alaska recount yes. this year, the court has managed to avoid having that decision figure prominently in any subsequent things. So that's an example mm-hmm. of the court taking a super hot potato issue, but trying to write their decision in a way that circumscribes how much impact mm-hmm. it has mm-hmm. beyond that particular case.
We'll look further at the influence of the Supreme Court on American public opinion and, well, history, too, for that matter, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, Charles Franklin and Leanne Kosaki, and we're looking at the United States Supreme Court influences upon it and, in turn, its influences, particularly upon American public opinion. Let's get to that influence on American public opinion, and I suppose we'd have to get a little bit into how you would even determine such a thing. Big, complicated question.
It is. And the theory of this was that the court, because it's a prestigious, magisterial, legitimate body, we were talking earlier about their robes, for example, when it reaches decisions, confers legitimacy on the side that it chooses, that this nonpartisan body reaches wisdom in the interpretation of the law. And that theory was pretty prominent throughout the 50s and 60s, but by the late 70s and early 80s had begun to wear a little bit thin. The court couldn't be demonstrated to just raise support for the positions that it chose. And it was difficult from a measurement perspective because you really needed, at least from the public opinion side, some questions in national polls that asked about an issue before the court decided it and then asked about the same issue after the court had decided it. And that had never been high enough on the agenda of, like, the Gallup poll yeah. and other national pollsters. So Tom Marshall wrote a book in the late 70s, I think it was, in which he went through every Gallup poll question that was remotely related to a court decision and tried to find it asked before and again after the decision. But despite dozens of prominent cases, he had a very hard time finding questions where Gallup had asked or others had asked the same question before and after.
Sure.
Or the gap might be particularly large, so you might not ask the after question for 2 years after the court had mm-hmm. ruled. So how do you know it's the court rather than anything else? So what you really need to address this is either by luck or by design find a question that's asked before the court rules and then exactly the same question asked immediately after a decision. That's the best chance you have of isolating the effects.
I saw when I was reading about your work that the two of you got this lasting contribution award for an article that you did having to do with public opinion in the court. in a study you did. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that research you did as collaborators?
Right. Well, I think the thing that had always bothered me, besides the issue that Charles talked about, was really another issue, which was, well, actually two issues. One had to do with awareness. That is, if you think about whether the court would have impact, obviously one question that had to be answered was, to what extent do people even know about a court decision? To what extent does the media report on an issue? Lots of times, you know, you'd watch the news and a Supreme Court decision might come out and maybe there's like a little 20-second snippet and then it's gone and there's just not a whole lot of attention paid to the court. And so that was one issue, was awareness. To what extent does the public know about decisions? To what extent does the media cover it? The other had to do with the structure of opinion, which I think was something else, which was the sort of predominant view was, well, when the Supreme Court makes a decision, then, or issues a decision, then the public automatically, like a bunch of little sheep, says, well, that's great, and they just go along. And it wasn't at all clear that was the only type of reaction. Certainly, if you looked at what happened during the civil rights period, there were lots of examples of the public saying, heck no, we're not going along with that. We think that's the wrong decision. And so one of the things that was important, we both thought, actually, in looking at public opinion and in response to Supreme Court decisions, was to look at those factors as well. And so we were actually very lucky in that we were able to find an issue, that is abortion, where there were the questions in the time frame that we needed, as well as good evidence that there was a fair amount of awareness, and then we could take a look at what was going on in response to the court's decision. So it was, to some extent, just a great fortuitous choice, but it was also very nice because we were able to show not only that here was in a situation where the public was very aware of a court decision, yes, indeed, it did look like people responded to the court's decision, but that the ways in which they responded to the decision were not in just becoming more positive about the court's, becoming more in agreement with the court's finding, but actually could be also to become more polarized, that is, become more committed to opposition to the court's decision, which is another aspect of what happened in the wake of Roe versus Wade.
So what you demonstrated with this research was that this segment of the public that was polled had a specific attitude toward this issue before the court ruled on it, and that their attitude changed after this court ruling, and that it changed in the direction of the court ruling in many cases. Number of cases.
This is academic research, right? So it's complicated how it moves. But what we were able to do, and through luck, really, I wish we could take credit for this, a major national survey called the General Social Survey is conducted in February every year. So in 1972, they had done a survey. The court's Roe versus Wade decision came down in January of 73, and then this survey was conducted, as usually scheduled, in February, so almost immediately after the Roe decision. But we were also lucky because it asked not just a single abortion question, but a set of six abortion questions, three of which asked, do you think abortion should be allowed to protect, say, the life and health of the mother? There's a serious defect in the child. And so those dealt with health-related issues to abortion. The other three questions dealt with what we called more discretionary reasons. The mother doesn't want another child, the mother's too poor to care for the child, and so on. So there were two different aspects here. And public opinion was differently split on those before the decision. There was very large-scale support for abortions in the case of health reasons, upwards of 80% approval of abortion in those cases.
Before the decision.
Before the decision. But a much more divided public on the discretionary reasons before the decision. So what we found was that first, after the decision, support for health reasons actually did go up in just the way that the legitimacy of the court would suggest. But it also started at a high level to begin with. But then what we found that was different from that older theory was that on the discretionary reasons, overall support didn't change, but polarization increased. That is, people who might be predicted to be more pro-abortion became even more pro-abortion, but people who were opposed to abortion ahead of time went the other direction, and the court's decision actually energized them to become more opposed.
Does it require you to become a psychologist to explain why?
In the world of political psychology, in effect, it does. And this is where our work on the Supreme Court also links up with other work on public opinion more generally, that people take their cues about what to believe about politics from people around them. So Leanne was talking earlier about awareness of court decisions, and credit where credit's due. This was one of Leanne's direct parts in this research, was pointing out to me, hey, you know, some of these people didn't hear about the decision. We should compare them to the people who had heard about the decision. Sure enough, when you looked at the data that way, those who had not heard of the decision in February were completely unchanged on either of these two discretionary or health reasons compared to a year earlier. It was only those who had heard that showed these results I was saying earlier. So that was critical because it shows that it's not just that the public had changed in the year between the two surveys, but it was really hearing or not hearing about the court specifically that made this effect. The second part was, is this just everybody polarizing more, or is it more selective? We were able to show that Catholics showed more polarization on the discretionary abortions after the ruling.
In other words, they were more against discretionary abortions.
Became more opposed. Mm-hmm. But if they didn't attend services regularly, they didn't change. And so this was the last bit of our finding, was that it's your social environment as well, that many political issues pass us by. We become aware of them, but we don't start talking about them in church or at the corner bar or at work. And in those cases, there's not very much social influence to reinforce our views. But in the one area that we had the data to check, highly involved Catholics were much more likely to absorb the message from their environment that this was a decision to oppose, whereas those who are of the same faith but not particularly regular attenders, they didn't show any of that influence. So it's both awareness, which is probably the most important direct influence, but then it's also the reinforcement of your social environment that leads you to interpret exactly the same decision as one that leads you to greater support of abortions in this case, or leads you to greater opposition. In other words, all of our reactions to politics are mediated by the social environment, what our friends and neighbors and fellow parishioners think.
But that can be somehow catalyzed by something like a Supreme Court decision, which makes everybody on the street and in church and in the bar talk about it.
Absolutely. Right. You could have talked about these issues before the court's decision, but its decision certainly gives you the opportunity to talk about it.
Do you think some of that is that the court itself issues not only a ruling, but also a dissent, and some of the dissents are so eloquently worded that it perhaps takes two sides of an issue and, you know, creates a sort of polarized ruling in a way, especially if you've got a 5-4 decision or something else. I saw a quote by Lonnie Guinier where she said, dissenting justices may educate, inspire, and mobilize citizens.
Right.
Are there instances of that? Do the dissents get nearly the publicity that the majority opinions do?
That's a good question. I don't think so, at least not historically. Certainly, I think that has changed recently. And I think one of the things that's been interesting is to look at the increased public attention to the Supreme Court generally, not only the decisions, but who sits on the court. And I think that much of what we talk about now with respect to the Supreme Court's impact on public opinion will probably change because of that increased attention by the media. Just real one, just really small but kind of interesting finding is, I think it's the Pew Research Center did a study and found that more people knew that Justice Roberts was conservative. This is sort of a little bump up. If you compared a study that was done, I think it was 5 years ago, to one today, there's a little bit of a bump. And it's interesting that there's that greater awareness. It's not great. 39% of the folks who responded would say that. But it was interesting to see that there was a slightly higher level of attention being paid to the courts, and that was translating into a little bit more awareness and a little bit more, perhaps more knowledge about the court.
I think one of the things that dissents do is give interest groups an opportunity to pick up the argument. So, mm-hmm. you know, the headline in this example is the court legalizes abortion. The dissents don't rise to that headline status.
Right.
But anyone concerned about the issue can look to the dissents to find mm-hmm. legal arguments that they can use and then filter back. And so, and the other is the greater politicization of the court certainly means that for practically any decision that's reached these days, there will be some interest groups on both sides promoting their interpretation of the decision or the dissent. Mm-hmm. So it's not direct. I think very few of us, certainly not me, rush to read the dissents of every case or, for that matter, even the decisions. But for the people whose jobs it is to care about what the court does, there's ammunition there that can be used for further debate.
When you say the politicization of the court, you're talking about from the outside rather than the inside.
Yes. I am. Yes. That, you know, I think it's probably arguable that the court has, through almost all of our history, dealt with controversial issues that did politicize the court. But if you go back to, and certainly the New Deal is a great example of that, but the Warren Court of the 1950s and 60s that greatly expanded individual rights and changed the civil rights movement and other areas also served to greatly polarize the court. And as the conservative movement has made great inroads through the Reagan and first Bush administrations and their court appointments, several of whom still sit on the court, through the second Bush administration, with some interludes for Democrats making a few appointments, we've further seen that polarization. But then it gets filtered into public opinion so that now Democrats and Republicans are more likely to hear interpretations of decisions that come from their side's spokespeople in ways that are perhaps more intense today than they were 70 years ago, let's guess.
Is there more research being done? Are you planning to do more research, asking more questions about the public opinion being influenced by the Supreme Court?
There's been a good bit of follow-up on this. As you said, we won a lasting contribution award for this, which I think mostly means we're getting old.
Well,
it's been around long enough for it to be called lasting. But happily, there has been a lot of follow-up on this. And as with all social science research, you don't always find these results. But they've held up enough in enough settings and enough cases that I think the idea that the court has some impacts and the subtleties of the impact may be debated, but the idea that there is an impact, I think, is less debated. The other thing is awareness. The question that Leanne and I, and especially Leanne, initially were interested in. It's clear that much of the public does not follow the court in close detail. I think the Packers game on Sunday might get a little more coverage than the court typically does, a little more interest. But we found in some subsequent research that anywhere from 5% might know about a really obscure decision, but up to 40-45% know about pretty important decisions, and they know almost immediately, within a couple of 3 days of the decision, that level of awareness is there. Then you go to extraordinary decisions like Roe versus Wade or Brown v. Board of Education, which not only affect public opinion in the short term, but spawn social movements, the Right to Life movement, the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. And then those, of course, have much greater impacts and awareness, but it's no longer just the court. It starts some of that in motion or helps it along. But the bottom line is, from our point of view, if 30 to 45% of the public becomes aware of an important but not landmark decision, that really does penetrate a fairly significant fraction of the public.
I was wondering how many people could name the nine justices and know what cases are coming up.
Very few.
Yeah.
But one of the studies that we did with our former colleague Bert Kritzer was, because the court's docket is known ahead of time, we started a survey that began in January and ran through August, in which we asked a national sample every night. We interviewed people daily through that period. As you know, the court's going to decide a variety of issues this year. We're interested in whether you happen to have heard if the court has made a decision on these cases. And then we'd give a little description, a vignette about what a case was about, and ask, have you heard or not? A lot of our colleagues thought we'd have tremendous numbers of people saying, oh, yeah, I've heard of that case. But in fact, what we found was very few false positives. Less than 2% before a decision ever were saying, oh, yes, they've decided that case. But almost immediately after the decision came down, within 3 or 4 days, that number would bounce up. Now, what was interesting was, of course, how much media coverage it got determined how high it bounced. But it penetrated almost immediately, and as I said, up to the high 30s, low 40s for some major decisions. And interestingly, it only fell off a little bit over the 6 months or so that we watched the issues after the decision. So it's like some segment of the public pays enough attention to hear of a decision, to remember that decision, and actually to continue to remember it for several months afterwards. Though, of course, a minor decision on some obscure tax policy doesn't penetrate very far.
More on the Supreme Court when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. Justices are teachers, but their classes are very poorly attended. That's a comment by Gerald Rosenberg about the lack of influence of the Supreme Court. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guests are Charles Franklin and Leanne Kosaki. I'm curious about the fact that we have a U.S. Supreme Court that's not elected, but here in Wisconsin and other states, some other states as well, we elect our Supreme Court justices. What do you think of that difference?
Well, that's really the result of our federal system. And the idea is at the federal level, we appoint justices and judges. But at the state level, states are free to adopt whatever type of selection mechanism they would like. And there certainly are very interesting to watch in terms of the types of selection methods they've adopted, where some states have elected judges and often or sometimes on a partisan basis. Some have appointments. They're modeled very much on the federal system. And there are lots of discussion about whether that's good, particularly lately with the increased prominence of state judicial elections and more out-of-state or state interests. Exactly, in terms of campaign donations. And so that's been something that states many people have been looking at and wondering about the perception, whether those methods lead to a perception of biased judiciary or an unfair judiciary, whether there should be public support for public funding of those elections, whether they should go to nonpartisan elections, whether they should go with appointments. And so that's been very interesting to follow.
That all gets back into the media then again, doesn't
exactly.
it? The influence of the media on elections.
Right.
And what we know about the people that we're voting for, whether partisan or nonpartisan elections. You know, earlier Leanne was talking about the problem of where does the U.S. Supreme Court fit within representative institutions and what the Founding Fathers in the Federalist Papers were talking about there. And I think this question of whether states elect or appoint justices or judges is another part of that. That in a democratic, republican form of government, it's really exceptional that the founders created a judiciary that deliberately insulated judges from those popular control mechanisms of elections. Whereas a lot of the states, especially in 30 or 40 years ago, had popularly elected judges, again, whether partisan or not. And the problem of the media and what we know about the candidates is a very real one. My first semester of graduate school, I was new to the state, the state of Michigan. I went in to vote, and I got down the list of ballots, and there was the Supreme Court up for reelection. And they labeled each justice, Justice so-and-so, Justice so-and-so. So you really knew who the incumbents were. So I initially went and voted for all of the incumbents. And then I thought, what kind of fool am I? Maybe they're bad incumbents. So I switched the levers back. This was an old lever machine. Voted for all the challengers. And then I thought, wait a second, these challengers may be goofballs. So finally, I just unvoted for everybody for the Supreme Court because I realized I had absolutely no idea as a newcomer to the state who the good guys were, who the bad guys were. But also from the point of view of Republican form of government, I didn't know which of these people might reflect my preferences and which ones don't reflect my preferences.
There's no party indication?
There was not justices? In the case of that mm-hmm. particular Michigan ballot. Just as here, as we're coming up on a Supreme Court race, we have nonpartisan judicial elections in the state. And so, again, if you're a newcomer to the state, as I was, or you don't follow this very closely, it's very hard for a voter to have much of an idea of who these people are and what their judicial philosophy, that term we used earlier,
represents. Do parties typically, though, line up behind a judicial candidate? Or is that a tricky thing to do?
Well, it's often not done openly or directly. But, you know, again, the problem here is that people who follow judicial elections closely don't have a hard time telling you who's the liberal, who's the conservative, who's the current or former Democrat or the current or former Republican. But those don't represent all of the voters in these elections. And so if you believe in a representative form of government, and if you think the point of having judicial elections is for citizens to translate their preferences into a choice of judiciary, it seems like you might want voters to have that kind of information. If, on the other hand, as the founders seem to believe of the U.S. judiciary, you really want these people insulated from the day-to-day political pressures, then you appoint them, and therefore, who gets to be president, or in our case, who got to be governor, would have a direct influence on the composition of the court, but it would be slow, and it would take place over time, and it might get out of step, but it could be corrected by future elections. But it could also mean that you as a citizen don't get to express your preferences about legal issues as directly as you might like. So I don't think this is an easy one to answer. It raises some really fundamental questions about a Republican form of government.
Well, the other consideration that's interesting here is it's not just about Republican preferences, but also has something to do, I think, especially in the judiciary, with merit. And one of the issues about an election is that because of various political pressures, folks might vote for someone who is not very good in terms of their maybe legal background or legal experience. And so I think one of the things that's been interesting is the introduction of sort of combination systems where people are maybe initially appointed. So there's that sort of bow to an idea that the governor or whoever, a judicial board maybe, would select a candidate in a nonpartisan fashion based on merit. And then that person would serve for a set period of time and then come up for an election, a retention election. Those systems have been very popular and were adopted. And I think, by and large, I think people have been pretty happy with those systems. But I think, again, the issue has come up with judicial elections. I think in the history of judicial elections is pretty much people haven't been aware of who are these people that are running. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happened over time is that people have become more and more aware, especially as courts have become important in making decisions about things like product liability, about environmental issues and various other kinds of policy issues, that various companies and parties have begun to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should be interested in these judicial elections. Maybe we should be advertising or advocating on behalf of the candidates that we think would be most receptive to our view. And so I think that's what has happened with the elections, that has kind of muddied the waters a little.
Well, we do have to remember, I think, that you know, even the Electoral College was designed to insulate the election of government officials from direct result of public opinion and direct vote. Yeah.
This also directly confronts the issue of whether judges or justices just interpret the law, back to the call the balls and strikes analogy, or whether there is something intrinsic about judicial philosophy that's going to differ for different people elected or appointed to the courts. And that, I think, is an enduring dilemma of our form of government rather than one that's sort of trivially fixed by a small change in whether we elect or appoint or retain judges.
A few years ago, Norman and I did a show with Chief Justice Shirley Abramson just about the state Supreme Court. One of the things that Chief Justice Abramson mentioned was her interest in outreach, court outreach, sort of taking the court on the road, sort of demystifying to some extent the court. I'm just curious, with both of you having worked in this area of the Supreme Court, what sort of reforms you might want to see either at the federal or state level in terms of the Supreme Court?
I've taken the contrarian view in a little bit of writing on this, in that I think if you're going to have an elected judiciary, there's actually an advantage in making it a partisan election, because the party labels Democrat and Republican help average folks understand something about the consequence. Where is the philosophy of this candidate likely to lean? Where is it for this one? When we have the nonpartisan elections, we add an extra difficulty in sorting out that. But I don't take a particular position on whether election or appointment itself is better. What I do like is the idea of a better informed electorate able to link our preferences to our votes. And parties do provide that much, at least.
I tend to be sort of conservative on these things, at least for the federal. It's been interesting because the issue that has come up just a little bit at the last Supreme Court confirmation hearing was the idea that perhaps the Supreme Court needed not a life tenure, but there should be fixed terms. Maybe there should be a set time for members of the court to retire, something along those lines. And it seems to me that the system we have has worked fairly well. Now, granted, people live a lot longer than they used to, but I think at least in terms of the Supreme Court, that the life tenure and the selection process seems to have served us well. So I don't see any need for changes there. I think the point Charles was trying to make is that if you were going to have elections, it's probably a good idea to maybe counterintuitively make them partisan as opposed to nonpartisan. But again, whatever system people choose, I think the ultimate holy grail is trying to select meritorious judges and justices who will serve in a way that speaks to a higher level than simply politics, sort of crass politics.
Well, stay tuned and see how these things develop in terms of what people learn about their Supreme Court and the way it is chosen. Our guests have been Charles Franklin and Leanne Kosaki. Thanks for being with us. A fascinating hour.
Yeah,
thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air, when once again Lisa Cooper will share with us her insights into the life, the colorful life, and the very colorful writings of one of England's great authors, his name, Geoffrey Chaucer. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.